Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Ambassador Robert Hormats joins us now, as I said, the vice chair of Kissinger Associates. Great to see you. Great to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
As always. Let's start with the import of this trip. The first trip a sitting president takes is always a big deal. There's a sense that he is fleeing or escaping some of the drama in Washington on this one as well. Does that make this trip easier in a way? He can sort of wholly focus on what he's doing overseas, or is the drama in Washington going to really distract from him, do you think, while he's gone?
I think it's the latter. I think there's going to be continued drama in Washington, and not only that, the drama in Washington makes a lot of the foreign leaders with whom he'll be meeting a little bit more concerned about his focus and about his staying power and about whether he's going to be able to take the kind of leadership role in the Western world and in the global economy and the global security order that they would like to see. A president distracted at home traditionally is able to spend less time, less energy, and give less attention to global leadership.
How ambitious is this itinerary? I've seen a lot of people say this is a 9-day trip, 5 stops, 2 big summits. That's a lot.
It's enormously ambitious, and he's going to be doing a lot of things. I've gone on these long trips, and at the end of 9 days, you're tired, and B, your mind is sort of focused on so many things, it's hard to digest anything new. But I think he has some very good advisors in the National Security Council, although the State Department, which normally plays a major role in planning these trips, really, except at the top, doesn't have very much leadership at this point. So it makes it difficult. These are very intricately planned and run trips, and without full State Department participation, it makes it a little more difficult. But the key point for him, I think, is to understand he's going out among very different cultures, Saudi Arabia in particular, the Arab world. He has very little experience there. Yet it's critical that he demonstrate American support for cooperation with these Gulf countries, particularly Saudi, but the other countries as well, and to figure out the right line and the right strategy. If he wants to take a leadership role, he has to have a clear strategy. He just can't chat with them. He has to have a strategy. They have to believe that it's helpful, and they have to believe that he's going to stick to it. That's very important.
What's the bubble like? As you said, you've been on these trips before. This is a president who avowedly likes to watch cable news, likes to be engaged with the zeitgeist, what's going on, what people are saying about him. When you're moving from city to city, from place to place, and you're in this security bubble, how difficult is it to keep apprised of what's happening, not only in the country around you, but in your home country, many thousands of miles away?
Actually, that part's fairly easy. With modern communications, presidents get briefed very, very frequently while they're sitting in their compartments on Air Force One on what the press is saying about what they have said or done in the previous country they visited and what's going on in the country that they're about to visit. So he'll be in close contact with what's going on. That's the problem with the distraction, though, because he's going to be trying to follow all these various convoluted events going on here while he's on this trip and not being able to focus as much time on the trip as he should be.
Robert Hormats with us with Kissinger Associates. Good morning, everyone. We've got a generous half hour with Ambassador Hormats. We'll talk about NATO here in our next section because David Gura is too busy this morning to spend time with me. He'll spend it with the important leader, the Secretary General. Is that the
exactly,
right title?
Yes.
The Secretary General of NATO as well. I would suggest, Ambassador Hormats, that the dearth of talent within the Trump administration really comes home to play on these trips. Give us a vignette. You're on Air Force One. You figured out the food's lousy, the coffee's subpar, you know, the usual thing. The glamour's gone. You're the team, except he doesn't have the team previous administrations have had. How lonely is it without the correct staffing of state and defense?
Well, it makes it a lot more difficult, as you've correctly pointed out. The State Department has people on the ground in all these countries. You need to rely on them. You need to have ambassadors there. They have very few ambassadors out there. They have very few people at senior level in the State Department. So it makes it much more difficult to plan the trips, and it makes it much more difficult to get the kind of information and judgments that you need from around the world to implement what you want to do. And the other problem is that they really don't have a highly developed strategy development system in place yet. McMaster is a very good guy, and he's Tillerson's a very good guy, and there are many others, Mattis as well. But you need to have a National Security Council process that organizes a strategy and an
area. I want to suggest, and I would never put words in your mouth, sir, that Hormats got off the airplane exhausted in some South American country at one point, didn't know where he was, didn't know what the city was, and didn't know who he was meeting, and there was some 33-year-old cherub there that saved your butt. Is that person there to save the President of the United States tail on an 8-day trip?
Well, I always tried to anticipate where I was going and what I was
doing. Did you ever wake up and not know?
There were certainly moments. But what these people on the ground can do is bring you up to date with events in real time. What's going on today? What happened last night? Give you a very, very current picture of what's happening. So while you may have your strategy and you may know what country you're in, you may know who you're going to see, there's no substitute for having very immediate on-the-ground input into your thinking and into what you say and what's going on in the country. Right. You have to have a real-time understanding of that. And the State Department people on the ground do. And I still think you'll be able to get that because there are good people on the ground.
David Gurrow, did you see how the ambassador sidestepped my question of did he ever wake up somewhere and not know where he was? He was elegant on that.
How do you approach a summit like these? You have a president here who, in the last week or so, he said that, you know, he wasn't sure of how he was briefed on some intelligence matters. A lot of briefing goes into this.
Yeah.
You stick to script at these summits. How difficult is that for somebody who's new to the job to figure out and to do?
He has to learn to stick to scripts. He has to learn to read his intelligence. He has to learn to read his briefing papers in advance and absorb them. And you just can't go into these summits and read your documents. Some people do. But people want to know you have command of the issues, not just that you're reading something that someone's put in front of you, but you have a command of the issues. You understand the problems they're facing. You have a strategy for working with them on those problems. And that you really believe in these global institutions. You believe in a global economic order, traditionally led by the United States and other Western countries, that you believe in a strong alliance and that you're going to do things at home and internationally to implement those. They're going to be testing not just what he says, but what he really thinks. Is he going to change his mind? Is he going to work with them? Is he going to listen to them? And if he wants a strong America, he's got to have a strong alliance. America's strong in part because it's strong in itself, and in part for the last 70 years because it had strong and reliable allies. He's got to demonstrate that he wants to maintain those allies. He wants to maintain the global economic order because it's been very good for the United States, despite the anti-globalization people. Global trade and finance have been very good for the United States and for our alliance system.
David Gurrow and Tom Keene in New York. This is Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio with Ambassador Robert Hormats, the vice chair of Kissinger Associates. We'll get to NATO in just a sec. I'll take advantage of you being here to prep a little bit for my interview coming up at 8:30. But let me ask you first about the Belt and Road Forum we saw in Beijing last week, a big event for the Chinese president, his vision for what China is going to do, the role it's going to play globally. It was at the Daitai State Guest House. We saw President Vladimir Putin playing the piano there before meeting with the Chinese president. What was your takeaway from it? What's China trying to do here? What's your perspective on China's ambitions, its global ambitions vis-a-vis this program?
Well, in terms of scope and in terms of the breadth of the initiative and the depth of the initiative, this is equivalent to the Marshall Plan 70 years earlier. And it's in part about strengthening Chinese ties in the region, in Southeast Asia and Central Asia and elsewhere. But it has a broader objective as well, and that is to strengthen Chinese ties and Chinese connectivity with Europe. It sees Europe as a big market. It sees Europe as a source of new technology. And if you look at the old Silk Road, It was really between Europe and China. It went through Central Asia, went through other parts of the world, but that was it. And I think China's goal, China's scope, China's ambitions are to strengthen ties with Europe, and this infrastructure build-out is one way of doing it. Also, of course, it strengthens their role in Asia, and since the United States has dropped out of the TPP, China will be influencing the development of rules in the region with its own trade agreement, the RCEP, and therefore that will not be helpful to American companies. It's not anti-American, but it certainly is going to instill rules in the region that are somewhat different and less conducive to American interests than the TPP would have been.
So this NATO summit is coming up on the 25th next week, and we've heard mixed messages from this administration about NATO. The president spoke at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy this week. He said, quote, "I will strengthen old friendships and seek new partners, but partners who also help us, not partners who take and take and take." He has been almost singly focused on funding for defense when it comes to NATO allies. How is that rhetoric going to play out when all of these leaders gather in Brussels next week?
Well, other administrations have been encouraging the Europeans to devote 2% of their GDP to defense. And I think that is a reasonable thing to do. On the other hand, I think he underestimates dramatically the role that many NATO countries are already playing in support of American interests. After 9/11, NATO invoked Article 5. They all joined the United States and said, if there's an attack on the United States, it means, in effect, there's an attack on us, and we're going to work with you in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So NATO troops, NATO country troops, have been very actively involved in various parts of the world, fighting alongside of American troops. He needs to understand that. He also needs to understand that if he wants to have a strong role in reducing the incursions of Putin, not just into Iran and Eastern Europe, particularly the Ukraine, but also the risks that could occur in the Baltics. So he's got to work with NATO, strengthen cooperation in NATO. And Putin's goal is to divide countries in Europe, support right-wing populist parties, divide them internally, divide Europe in terms of the EU, and divide Europe from the United States. And he has to demonstrate that he understands Putin's objectives, and he wants to strengthen cooperation with Europe, strengthen European countries, and strengthen the EU. Right. That's in America's interests. He's got to get that.
Robert Hormats, thank you so much. We're out of time. Next time you're on for 4 hours. John Tucker, make a note.
Do the full
Next
show.
Next time Bob Hormats is on for 4 hours.
Let's just make him, the host of the show.
Yeah, we can do that. Thank you.
Brilliant. So he's going to replace anybody, but
alongside her.
They say that the administration's an HR disaster, but then that explains Bloomberg surveillance. Yes. Keep it up, John Tucker. Ambassador Hormats, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Particularly after this.
Terrific show. Enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. This historic week and onward is. It's really, David, this interview you're doing today, could it be better timed?
No. Very grateful for it.
Between the domestic week and the foreign week to come. David Gura with the Secretary General of NATO. Look for that in the next hour. This is Bloomberg. This is a real treat. Luigi Zingales with us. We spoke to Professor Zingales of Booth School earlier about American investment. I think, David, in honor of your NATO discussion, we should go to Italy.
Yeah.
And that Mr. Trump traverses Italy.
Yeah, he'll be there for this G7 summit. We saw the Prime Minister of Italy meeting with the Russian president earlier this week. Give us some context here, the role that Italy is playing on the European stage and the world stage right now.
Unfortunately, plays the role of the troublemaker. Uh-huh. In the sense that Europe is doing well these days. There is a recovery. The recovery is getting stronger. In France, Macron won the presidential election. Everything seems to go in the right way, except Italy. Italy is still doing poorly economically, has a very large debt that is kept at bay by quantitative easing. But if this were to finish, then will create problems, and is politically unstable. It's due for an election by February. And at the moment, the leading party in the polls is kind of a populist party run by Beppe Grillo. So, and we don't know his ability to form a government to govern the country. If you think that Donald Trump is inexperienced, wait for Beppe Grillo.
How much connective tissue is there, as you see it, between the politics in all of these countries? So we saw a populism perhaps held back in France. You could say that. I'll put those words in your mouth. But is there something that is there a line that runs between the UK and France and Italy when it comes to the particular brand of politics?
I think there are certainly some elements in common, even if the situation, of course, are different. I think that the overwhelming fact is that the growth that has benefited some, especially in the US and in the UK, has not been broadly shared. And in Italy, this growth has not even existed. So the situation is even worse. And I think that when you combine a dismal economic performance with a generalized perception of corruption, I think that you have all the elements for some populist reaction. I think that my surprise has been how sort of tame this has been so far, not how strong it's been. And yes, has been sort of kept back in France, but we have to say almost by luck, because if 3% had switched in the first round, we would have had a Le Pen-Mélenchon second round that was pretty scary.
Is the growth distribution in Europe like in the United States? Is the inequality or the advantage of growth going to too few?
I think it's less pronounced than in the States, but also the growth has been lower. So when it comes to the substance, it's how many people are better off today than 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The numbers, at least for Italy, are even worse because the growth has been non-existent.
David, I think Greg Villiers, who's been such a good help to us, writes one of his most cogent notes ever this morning, out moments ago. And he begins with Peggy Noonan's Wall Street Journal weekend column, Democracy is Not Your Plaything. With us, Luigi Zingales, with a terrific perspective out of Chicago on the American economy, American capitalism, and maybe this strange thing called democracy. How swampy is the swamp, Luigi, and will it slow economic growth?
I think the swamp is very swampy, and yes, it does reduce economic growth. And I think there were great expectations that President Trump will do something about it. And so far, we have not seen much action on that front.
What could he do? He talks an awful lot about the process of draining said swamp. He hasn't made much progress doing that. You look at his cabinet, there are a lot of people there, you could argue, have added to the swampiness of Washington. What would you counsel him to do to make the place a little less soupy, a little less swampy?
First of all, I think I will bring back a bit of antitrust enforcement. I think that at Chicago, we had a conference where I interview Judge Posner, who is probably the world expert on antitrust.
Yeah,
and he said very bluntly that antitrust is dead, that he was nominated judge by Ronald Reagan in 82, expecting to see a lot of cases, and he saw almost none. So I think time has come to be more aggressive on that front.
What else did Judge Posner say about the shape of the judiciary, the shape of the regulatory landscape right now? I think of him as somebody who's so prolific and so frank about the state of the American judiciary. What did he have to say?
Actually, first of all, I don't know whether I'm giving a scoop, but he's coming up with a new book about the judiciary pretty soon.
The CV gets longer.
Yes. Yeah. And it's not a flattering book vis-a-vis the judiciary. So that's problem number one.
Luigi, in the Peggy Noonan op-ed, she has a single sentence, which on a Friday is really important. Why is the president never careful? Are businesses now too careful? Is our diminished nominal GDP such that business and finance is too careful in this age?
I don't know whether it's because they're too careful. I think it's because they don't see a big incentive to invest. I think that part of the story is that most of their return to investment is not due to expansion, but it's due to the market power that they have. And so they don't want to compete against themselves by investing more. That's the reason why I think that having a stronger antitrust will actually spur investments, because it will spur competition.
What should we make of this news? The president going to Saudi Arabia first because the country was able to ink a big weapons deal with the help of Jared Kushner, senior advisor to the president, son-in-law of the president as well. Does that raise any red flags to you as you look at the role of that industry in particular in the U.S. and globally?
Yeah, I think that the way Donald Trump is using his family as advisor reminds of less developed countries where you have this sort of family power that extends. I don't think is a good sign for the U.S. economy. To be honest, on the other side, we didn't have much better. And this is the Clinton family is another sort of very powerful family with all the connections. So I think, unfortunately, this is a sign of the time, sign of how much the U.S. economy has degenerated into a chronic capitalist economy. Mm.
There's a great piece in Bloomberg Business Week this week by our editor-in-chief, John Micklethwaite. He posits, you know, if you were to look at President Trump is a CEO, would you keep him on in light of all that's happened here? I'll let listeners give it a read. But a point that he makes as well is that if a CEO were misspeaking, saying untruths, he would be called to account by the chairman of his board in many cases. And here we kind of draw the analogy out. Maybe Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, would be the equivalent of a chairman. Does he need to take a bigger role? Does there need to be more of a voice elsewhere in government, elsewhere in the Republican Party, keeping this president in check?
I think that, yes, the Republican Party has been a bit missing in action in doing the role of keeping the president in check. Now, I think that, to be honest, I don't have any sympathy for Trump, but there is a lot of attention in trying to find him and catch him in mistakes, which happens to every new president, but particularly a new president is not very popular with the media. So I think there is a bit too much of an attention, but certainly Donald Trump is not very smooth in the way he sort of behaves. But I think that besides the appearances, I think that the substance is what worries.
Do you have a sense of what his message is to business? You can look at his cabinet, you can look at who he's appointed, who he's hired, who he's met with at the White House. Can you crystallize what his message to business leaders is?
Yes, I think his message has changed quite a bit. When he was a candidate, he was flirting with more sort of populist issues or ideas. And when he became president, I think he turned into a very pro-business, not necessarily pro-market, but very pro-business president.
Is it a gilded age? You address this in your books with, I think, great understanding of American history. Is that all we're dealing with here? Is we've got a president who's part of the Gilded Age?
Absolutely. I think that my book now is 5 years old, believe it or not. And
yeah,
I think
great.
That.
Thank you for making
it. No, but I think that is still. I'm actually surprised how right I was, in a sense. I anticipated some of the themes that were present in the last campaign and are still present today. I think that is a long term trend, and we have not found a president like Theodore Roosevelt backing this trend.
Circle back to investment again. We began our conversation earlier this morning on the animal spirit. If we've got diminished yields, if we've got a diminished view on inflation, if the United Kingdom has flat wage growth, the reflation, once again, maybe it's not happening. And there's beautiful charts that show that disappointment for 10 years. Have you been surprised by that?
I think he's, I have to admit, a bit surprised I have been, even if, given we were recovering in the United States from a major financial crisis, this is not unusual. I think that the next few years will be crucial in that dimension, because the fact that after a financial crisis, there is a slow recovery, there is a tendency toward deflation, etc., this is unfortunately normal. But now we have turned page, and if we don't see real growth now, then it's a bigger problem.
Luigi Zingales, thank you so much for joining us with the Booth School Chicago this morning on Italy, on his Italy, and of course on I like what you said, the swamp.
That's right.
So we've got a major crisis, folks, major surveillance crisis, at least from my desk, David Gura. Twitter is down.
Twitter's down.
And I might suggest this is presidential primetime.
Yeah.
So you really wonder how this is going. I don't know where the president is right now. John Tucker is, he's not on the airplane yet, is he?
No, this afternoon. This afternoon. Something is technically wrong, the website tells me right
something,
now.
Something, okay, you have it too.
But you raise a good question. We joke about this, but I am curious if he's going to be tweeting throughout the trip. And, you know, there were a lot of people who were grateful for the pause after the announcement of that special counsel that the president was not tweeting in the immediate aftermath. Of course, he shattered that silence yesterday during surveillance with those two tweets, including the one declaring it to be the greatest witch hunt in American political history. And I must say, the congressman representing Salem, Massachusetts, had a great retort. He said,
yes,
judging from his position, he could say that that is, in fact, not the case. There are other examples in American history where the witch hunts have been
I travel to Salem, and I look at that literature. Salem is a very spiritual place, particularly, I might point out, at night. Walking around Eldridge Gerry's little town is something at night.
More weight here. Yeah.
It's very, very New England-y. Do you realize I've gotten through the week without talking about the Red Sox?
That's true. Or the Celtics.
And there's, well, the Celtics are doing better than me.
Yeah.
Good. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith. Incorporated, member SIPC. There's something new from Bloomberg. It's called Lens. Starting right now, you can use the Bloomberg iOS app off your iPhone or iPad, or our new Google Chrome extension to read any news story on any website, scan it, and then instantly see the news story's relevant market data from Bloomberg. In addition, see all the bios of the key people mentioned in the story. It's called Lens, and it is just that, a lens into the people and the data of any story you may be reading. Again, Lens brings you the power of Bloomberg's news and data. Download our iOS app or search for the Bloomberg extension at the Chrome Store to try Lens out. Learn more at Bloomberg.com/lens.
President Trump embarks on his first official overseas trip today. His first stop is in Riyadh, and from there he'll travel to Tel Aviv, Rome, and Brussels, where he'll participate in a NATO summit. The president has been critical of the alliance and of the financial commitments member states have made to it in particular, and that'll be one subject of debate at the meeting, which my next guest will oversee. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg joins me now from Brussels, and there are, as I understand it, sir, two big agenda items at this summit: burden sharing, what countries contribute to NATO, and counterterrorism. Let's take them in kind. The U.S. Secretary of State says he wants to see these countries make their commitments by the end of the year or outline plans to get there by the end of the year. How feasible is that, do you think? How reasonable an expectation is that?
That's absolutely feasible, because we are now discussing concrete proposals on how we can agree on the concept of national plans outlining how the different NATO allies are going to make good on the promise they all made back in 2014 to stop the cuts in defense spending and then gradually increase and then move towards spending 2% of GDP on defense. And we have already seen that NATO allies have actually started to increase defense spending. They still have a long way to go, but they have turned the corner and started to move in the right direction.
There is so much on NATO's plate at this point. There's a migrant crisis. There's the issue of counterterrorism. How frustrated are you that so much focus has to be on funding, that we are talking so much here about how NATO defense is funded?
Defense spending, funding is critical, because we need the funds to finance all the different activities we do as the alliance. And NATO has to provide both what we call collective defense in Europe, responding to a more assertive Russia illegally annexing Crimea and destabilizing eastern Ukraine. But we also need to be part of the fight against terrorism, stabilize our neighborhood. And to do so, we need to invest more in defense. After the end of the Cold War, NATO allies reduced defense spending, and that's absolutely understandable, because when tensions are going down, it's possible to reduce defense spending. But now tensions are increasing again, and then we have to be able to increase defense spending again.
The President of the United States spoke at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy this week. He said, quote, "I will strengthen old friendships and seek new partners, but partners who also help us, not partners who take and take and take." I don't have to do too in-depth an exegesis there to interpret that he was talking about NATO. How damaging is that kind of rhetoric when you hear that?
Well, President Trump has clearly stated to me in several conversations, last when we met in the White House in April last month, that he is strongly committed to NATO, and that has also been the message from his security team, from the Vice President, from Secretary Mattis, Tillerson, and McMaster. And this is a commitment which we don't only see in words, but also in deeds, because the United States is now increasing its military presence in Europe for the first time in many, many years. At the same time, all allies understand that we need a fair burden sharing, and that's also the reason why 28 allies agreed that those who are spending less than 2% of GDP on defense have to increase, and they have started to move in the right direction.
What are you hoping to hear from the President of the United States this week when he speaks to you and allies gathered in Brussels?
I hope and I expect that he will reiterate his strong commitment to NATO. But also, of course, his expectation that NATO should do more in the fight against terrorism and also invest more in defense. And I expect so because that has been his message since the elections, and also because strong NATO is not only good for Europe, but a strong NATO is also very important for the United States. Two world wars and the Cold War have taught us that stability in Europe is also important for prosperity and security in North America. And we have to remember that the only time NATO has invoked our Article 5, our collective defense clause, was after an attack on the United States, 9/11, 2001, and we have been engaged in Afghanistan, our biggest military operation, as a direct response to an attack on the United States.
There was a piece in Foreign Policy magazine I want you to respond to. It alleged that this summit is going to be different because of the participation of President Trump, that speeches are going to be shorter, they're going to be limited, that there won't be a detailed declaration to follow the summit. Can you confirm that those two changes are in fact being made? And if they are being made, it's because of the participation of President Trump.
It's totally wrong, the whole story, because this meeting is a normal meeting. It's conducted and organized in exactly the same way as we organize and conduct other NATO meetings, other summits and other ministerial meetings. It's true that it's not going to be a communique or a public statement, but that was also the case when we had a similar meeting when George Bush was newly elected president back in 2001, because this is not a full-fledged NATO summit. This is a meeting where we have a new U.S. president meeting all the other NATO leaders. But it will be an important meeting, a focused meeting, because we will focus on burden sharing, defense investments, and on what more NATO can do to fight terrorism.
Talking with the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg here on Bloomberg Television and Bloomberg Radio. Defense ministers were gathered in Brussels earlier this week, and they discussed NATO possibly joining the coalition fighting the Islamic State. Do you expect that issue is going to be resolved by the conclusion of this summit on the 25th?
NATO already provides support to the coalition fighting Daesh or ISIL. We provide support with our AWACS surveillance planes, and we train Iraqi forces. The question is whether NATO can do even more, and also whether NATO should join the coalition and be a formal member of the coalition. Some allies are strongly advocating that because it will be a strong expression of political support, and to also increase our ability to coordinate with all the NATO allies that are already member of the alliance. So this is an issue which is now discussed, and I expect decisions to be made soon.
How big a concern is intelligence sharing? Is that a hurdle for some allies, especially in light of the meeting we've heard reported about at the White House, in which the president revealed some sensitive information to the Russian ambassador to the U.S. and to the Russian foreign minister?
Intelligence sharing is an important part of the NATO cooperation, and I appreciate that NATO allies and especially the United States are sharing intelligence with NATO and other allies almost every day. And that is very important for the strength of NATO. And I'm confident that all NATO allies are able to handle the intelligence they receive from other allies and from partners.
The United States is weighing sending more military personnel to Afghanistan, the expectation being that NATO would match whatever the U.S. were to send. The U.S. saying it plans to make a decision on that after this meeting concludes next week. If they do decide to send more troops to Afghanistan, how quickly could NATO react in kind?
So we can react quite quickly, but first we have to decide on how many troops we are going to have there. We have approximately 13,000 troops now in Afghanistan. Approximately half of them are U.S. troops, and the other half are European, Canadian, and coming from partner countries. And we are now discussing whether we should have an increase, not very big increase, but an adjustment of the force levels. Again, I expect decisions to be taken in the coming weeks. What is clear is that we will continue our military presence, train mission in Afghanistan, and then we are looking into whether there is a need for some increase in the troop levels.
Last question here. There was a huge ransomware attack last week. As you know, there was interference in the U.S. presidential election. I imagine cybersecurity is becoming a bigger concern for you at NATO. What is your greatest concern when it comes to cybersecurity and NATO's positioning to combat it?
So cyber threats are something we need to take really seriously, because we have seen more sophisticated, more intense, and more higher numbers, or more higher frequency of cyber attacks against NATO allies and against NATO networks. And therefore, NATO is responding by significantly increasing our cyber defense capabilities. We have also decided that cyber attacks can trigger what we call Article 5, our collective defense clause. So an attack, a cyber attack, can be regarded as an attack on all allies. We are also now establishing cyber as a military domain, meaning that we will have air, sea, land, and cyber as military, as I say, operational domains. And then we also support allies to help them improve their cyber defenses with joint exercises with a Center of Excellence in Tallinn, where we share technology, best practices, and we always have to adapt and change because the cyber threat is constantly changing, so we have to be ready to respond. And that's also what we did last Friday, where we warned all allies on the mounting cyber attack we saw last weekend.
This is maybe the best timed interview to get back to the soul of what Washington used to do. David, why don't you bring in our esteemed guest, the ambassador.
Yeah, great to have the ambassador, Max Baucus, with us, former senator, of course, from the great state of Montana, joining us now. Ambassador Baucus, great to have you with us here. Let me get your reaction, first of all, to what we've seen over the last week in Washington. I imagine you couldn't be happier to be 2,000 plus miles away in Bozeman. Are you happy with where we are now, the naming of a special counsel? Do you think that that's going to quiet the concern over this investigation?
I do. I'm quite pleased that a special counsel has been named for several reasons. One, it's going to tend to calm things down a little bit because now there's order, at least with respect to the degree to which the president may or may not have compromised the White House with Russia. But in addition to that, I like this because it's the rule of law is beginning to take hold. You know, we're a country of laws, and we now do have a special prosecutor who, under the law, is going to determine the facts. We know, is there obstruction of justice or not, and that's good.
Ambassador Baucus, if I go into the Nova Cafe in Bozeman, Montana, and get a decent breakfast, is all that's going on in your beltway, do people care across this country, or is it just an East Coast media frenzy?
Well, that's a good question. It's a little bit of both. They are kind of a shrug. They are concerned, don't like all that's going on. But to a large degree, many of them think, you know, that's kind of, well, that's Washington. You know, that's just what they do back there. They get all hot and bothered about things back there, and they just don't take care of us, spend time thinking about our issues. So I think a lot of people at the Nova Cafe are, you know, don't pay a lot of attention to all this. They do a little, but not as much as we'd like to think they should, those of us who are very involved in policy.
Oh, that's Washington. How do we get back to a different definition? How do we get back to a different Washington, one that I would imagine inspired you to run for office and decide to take up camp there for a while? How far are we from those days?
Well, we've drifted away for a long time. I was in the Senate 40 years, including the House of Representatives, 36 Senate, 4 in the House. And it's over time you could just feel slowly, members of the Senate drifting apart. We're just not spending a lot of time together. I think there are a lot of factors here. One is TV in the Senate. Another is just advances in communications technologies, which are at once aggregating but also disaggregating, because we in the Senate would speak directly to the cameras and to the country and a little less to each other in the Senate. And then, obviously, redistricting is hurt a little bit. And social media, the rise of social media, you add it all together, and we're not what we once were. And for some reason, the people, in my judgment, this is a bit presumptuous, who get elected these days are more inclined to push their narrow view than they are to listen to somebody else in the body to try to figure out a compromise.
How should the Democrats respond to all that we've seen this week? What is your advice to those? They're on the firing line. They've got to make the responses. They've got to talk the book. But Max Baucus, what should Democrats do after what we've observed this week?
Well, keep cool, keep calm, and focus on what people really care about. That tends to be jobs. That tends to be their kids and education. And, you know, people are basically the same almost worldwide. They want decent income, food at the table, and clean air, clean water, decent health care. And we should just do that. Mm-hmm. And the more we do and stay away from a lot of the stuff in Washington, gradually the message that people care about will sink in.
Has your optimism for there being policy change lessened after what we've seen over these last few weeks? You had some optimism that we would see some progress on policy on Capitol Hill. How big a distraction is what we've seen unfold here over the last couple of weeks? How much is that going to detract from work on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think it detracts significantly. Even though committees are holding hearings, they're trying to hold hearings, I see Ways and Means held one just a day or two ago. Still, everyone walking out of that hearing room is going to be asked by a reporter his or her reactions to the latest scandal of the day. And that's very distracting. But I'm pleased, frankly, that we now have a special prosecutor, which I think can attempt all that down. I think that's good.
Ambassador, did you walk across China in your term there, in your public
speech? Take a while.
No, but I did visit all the provinces. When I presented my credentials to President Xi Jinping, I told him I was going to visit all the provinces, and every time I saw him, he would check on me and make sure that I'm still visiting them. No, it's very important to visit the provinces.
Tell us about the vacuum that the Americans have given the Chinese to rebuild their proverbial and storied road.
Well, in my judgment, I think it's a big vacuum. The biggest geopolitical issued across my desk when I was over there 3 years was Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was so important to establish America's position in that part of the world. And it was so important to me. In fact, I got on a plane on my own, flew back to Washington, and met with 50 different members of the House and Senate for one full week on that issue alone, both bodies, both political parties. It was during the couple months before the election. Promoting and urging members of Congress to pass it. And I could tell pretty soon that by the body language of almost every member I talked to, it was not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
But it's by not passing it, we're giving, in my judgment, China a huge opportunity to step in and take advantage of our absence. Many ambassadors of Southeast Asian countries would talk to me and say to me, you know, and almost plead with me for America to pass TPP because that would enable those countries to push back a little more easily against China because we're present there. But our absence will make it more difficult for those countries to push back against China's political pressures, even military pressures, economic pressures. And add to that all the actions China's undertaking. Yeah. It's not just one bill, one road, which is massive, but there's something called the AIIB. There's something else called RCEP. China's got a vision. China's got a plan. Well, I think we'll head off to them, frankly.
Ambassador, we're out of time. We look forward to getting a briefing from you again. He's smarter than us. He's in Bozeman, Montana. Max Baucus, 36 years.
Big Trout.
And really enjoy talking with the senator from Montana. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.